that does a lot of the same work and doesn't make me want to take a shower and then take another shower and then take my skin off and wash my skin and then take another shower.
And welcome back to another episode of Exposing Ourselves. I'm Travis Ritchie, and this is episode 67. This is the show where we expose each other to new things. Matt, a big music fan, will assign me one of his favorite films. Oh, nope. That's the other way around. He will assign me one of his favorite music artists to listen to each week, and I, a movie buff, will give him one of my favorite films, and we come together on this podcast to discuss it all. And with me, as always, is my very good friend,
Matt Rundquist. Hey, Travis, how you doing this week?
Well, I don't know, actually.
I watched the movie Chinatown, and you listened to The Breeders.
Ah, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So how the heck are you, my friend?
I'm doing pretty well, pretty well. I spent a lot of time this week helping my wife out on a painting project. She had an apartment that she was painting, and so there was a very hard deadline because people were moving in on such and such a day. And so we had to have the apartment painted before that time, and so I helped her with that.
So you painted the inside of the apartment?
Yes. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Because the last big painting project you did, you were painting the outside of a house, right?
Yes, that was the outside of the house. Yeah.
Cool. Interesting. So, how does that? I'm slightly curious about the difference.
Painting inside versus painting outside. Painting inside is much, much easier. Yeah. Painting outside is a big pain in the butt. Everything is dirty. It's typically hot. There's wind to contend with. There's a lot of masking that you have to do, protecting things from paint going where you don't want it to go. It's a big pain in the butt. Indoors is much, much preferable.
All right. Nice. I have painted indoors once or twice. I remember in my old house in Minneapolis, the one that was right near the river, I wanted to paint one of the rooms, and I had it in my head to do this kind of marbleized style that my mom had actually done, and so I wanted to emulate that. So I had a bunch of different colors. I had gold, that one of the things you put like veins of gold with a feather, and I don't think I actually got it done. I think I did one coat of one color and called it quit. And it was not a big room even, so.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. People get paid to do it for a reason.
Well, that's good that you were able to help out.
Yeah, I was able to help out. And so I was able to sort of use my ill-gotten gains from that to buy some musical equipment, which was fun. Because, you know, it's not fun unless you buy something. Practicing is not nearly as much fun as buying stuff for your hobby. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah. I love the buying. The buying is fun.
yeah, for sure. Other than that, I've been getting ready. We're gearing up for Girls Rock in a couple days, a couple weeks here. It's the last week of June, and so we're getting ready for that. We did gear inventory this past weekend. We've rented the truck to move everything. We're getting ready to go for that. I won't be instrument coaching this time because I'm busy during the day at my actual job. I wasn't able to take vacation this year, but I'm going to be helping out on load in and load out, and then on show day.
Oh, that's great. Did I tell you that Keith Hampton let me know that his mom was in Ladies Rock?
No, we talked about that's many awesome weeks ago? News.
Yeah. So what
that's
a weird
great.
Coincidence
Did she have
was.
A good time? Did she enjoy the experience?
She said it was amazing. Yeah.
Where does, if it's not too much information, where does Mrs. Hampton live?
Oh, she lives in Lake Mills, so my hometown.
Oh, wait, she was in the Milwaukee Ladies Rock.
Yeah.
So I might have met her.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, we got to exchange info after the podcast, and maybe I know her now.
Yeah.
That'd be crazy.
I know, right? So it's just a weird coincidence. And then Keith was like, hey, and he told me this weeks ago when we talked about it, and I have forgotten to let you know until now. It just popped into my brain. Yeah. So that's awesome,
how about
man.
You? What are you up to?
Oh, my God. Well, so this weekend is LA Pride, and I, on Saturday, went to a beach Ultimate Frisbee Pridevitational, which is a huge event. I've done it every year that I've been in town for the last, I don't know, 10 years. And it brings in people from San Francisco and San Diego and all over the place. And it's just like, I don't know, a huge, I think we had 80 or 90 you know, just gays and gay-friendly people playing Ultimate Frisbee on the beach, and then a big party afterwards. And then today I went to the Pride Parade in L.A., all of which is something I would have said if I hadn't broken my toe on Friday.
Oh, no.
And if you'll peek at your pictures, your text thread, you can see the picture I just sent
goodness.
You. And it was...
That's not great.
It was very disappointing, to be honest.
How'd you do that?
So how is also an interesting story. I was sleeping on Friday morning, and I woke up at about 5:30 to that familiar sound of an animal about to throw up in your bed. Mm-hmm. And Coco was doing that hurting sound. Mm-hmm. And I panicked, and I threw off the covers and grabbed her, and I was going to lift her into the hallway. Mm-hmm. So that she could puke on the hardwood floor. And mm-hmm. But on the way out of the bed, I stepped on my backpack, I guess, and tripped and fell, and and just nothing worked the way it was supposed to. She ended up not only throwing up, but also, like, because I was kind of holding her and lifting her, it was kind of super... spread it was not
fantastic.
A unified mess to clean up, which then I had to clean up while I was in serious pain from my two toes that one apparently they're not fractured but just very, very, very badly sprained. It certainly feels like a fracture, and I went to the emergency room and got crutches and a wrap for it, and so I have been convalescing this weekend until now.
Well, I'm sorry to hear
around.
That. If it's any comfort to you, I did get to go to Milwaukee Pride.
Oh.
It was a good time.
A little bit of comfort.
Got to see a band that I really like called Bev Rage and the Drinks. They're a punk band led by a drag queen, which was a lot of fun. I've seen them a couple of... This was actually my third concert of theirs that I've seen. Really enjoyed it.
Well, ironically, then, the Breeders would have been a good band for Pride, too.
Well, yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah.
The other thing that
people might not get that joke.
Do we have to explain it to them, though?
Well, I don't know. I realized that Breeders is something that we would call straight people derogatorily, or like jokingly derogatorily, right? But also, breeding is a thing. So,
well,
that's
once
all
again,
I'd
like to remind our listeners that jokes are funniest when explained. So.
No, they know that. They know.
Yeah, they know that. They know it now because I told them.
Yeah, okay, great. Good for you.
And then the other thing that I wanted to say is that there was a drag show called The Legends of Drag. So during the early days of COVID, these two photographers from L.A., I believe, L.A. or Las Vegas, drove around the country visiting... different cities, different drag communities, and taking sort of glamour photos of older drag queens, queens of a certain age. And it's a fantastic book. They visited Milwaukee. They photographed six queens here. I really, really like... Well, it's seven queens, but two of them are twins. So, so there's six entries in the book from Milwaukee. But anyways, at Pride Fest, they had a Legends of Drag show that included... three of the Milwaukee performers that were in the book, and then three performers from out of town, a couple from Chicago and one from Las Vegas. And it was really, really just amazing. Just a wonderful, wonderful show, seeing these queens who have been in the business for 30 or 40 years, commanding a stage with thousands of people watching. They were on the main stage at Pride Fest. And it was awesome, and I really, really loved it. And shout out to all of them, especially my friend Shannon Dupree, who I've performed with in the past, and I go to her shows all the time, and, you know, we help each other move couches.
Aww.
And it was a really, real, just a pleasure and an honor to get to be there for that. So.
That's fantastic. Have you ever done drag, Matt?
Yes, I have. That's actually what I was saying when I said I had performed with
Shannon.
Oh,
okay. What's your drag name?
My drag name is Nina Menasha Ford, which is funny only to people from Wisconsin.
I love Nina Menasha Ford. That's great. I love that. I have done drag twice. One of which was for a sketch of mine that is online, where I played my own mom interrupting me while I was recording a vlog. And I really like it, actually, although the mom that I play is nothing like my own mother. And the other one was for, I guess I did another one for the Taylor Swift show when I thought I was going to do a series called the Taylor Swift show because it was going to be good search engine optimization. And so I put together this costume, and I did an episode, and I really liked the first episode, but I never did any more because no one watched it. It's probably because Taylor Swift isn't so popular, and no one was looking for Taylor Swift stuff.
Too obscure.
Yeah. The other time I did it was for a show called Murder by Murder at Acme, and it was an improvised murder mystery, and we had a cast one day that was all men, and so I asked the director, Brian Giovanni, if I could play a woman, and he was hesitant at first because he didn't know drag necessarily isn't appropriate for the period, and I was like, no, I don't want to play a drag queen, I want to play a woman. And it worked. It was interesting. It was a lot of fun.
A female impersonator, you weren't a drag
queen. Yeah, so that was a very interesting experience too. I don't make a great woman, but I would love to do it sometime where I had a little bit more help with makeup and stuff like that. There was one when I was in Japan. We have a really great drag queen who worked also at Universal Studios, and they were going to help me do the scene. I was doing reenactments. At the time, and they were going to help me do the scene from Devil Wears Prada, the turquoise, it's not turquoise.
Oh, I know.
It's, no, turquoise isn't the color, though. It's cerulean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was going to do that whole thing, but didn't end up having time before I had to leave. So, whatever.
Unfortunate.
But so how about we get into the meat of the episode? And
let's shake things up this week, Travis.
Let's shake things up and do the music
first.
Yeah, so tell me about the Breeders, man.
Well, the Breeders are a little bit of an indie rock supergroup, kind of. Supergroup is a term that's thrown around pretty loosely when people do side projects with one another. But Kim Deal from a very famous 1980s college rock band, The Pixies, and Tanya Donnelly of Throwing Muses decided to form a little... Yes?
Have we done The Pixies?
We have not done The Pixies. No.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Why is that interesting? Do you know the Pixies?
No.
Oh.
I've heard of them. So if you would ask the question, have you ever heard of the Pixies, I would actually be able to say, yes, I have, but I'm not familiar with them at all.
Okay. I've thrown around the idea
I'm sorry.
In my head of giving you the Pixies, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Unless you
give me that Planet of the Apes movie.
It'll happen.
So, anyways, Tanya Donnelly of Throwing Muses and Kim Deal formed a band with a couple other friends of theirs, and they recorded this album with Chicago recording engineer and producer and all around very opinionated guy Steve Albini, who died last month, and who I wanted to give you one of the albums that he recorded. To just give you a little taste of the type of music that he was into and that he really loved. Mm-hmm. And this is quieter than a lot of it, but the thing that I hope you got out of this, even if you didn't like the music itself, is that the immediacy, the sense that you were in a room with these four musicians playing this music. There weren't a lot of overdubs. All of the things are very well recorded, right? You can hear each of the instruments. You can hear the interplay between them. And there's not a lot of flash to this, right? It sounds like what it is. So it's indie rock from the late 80s, early 90s. I think the album was released in 1990. I don't know if it was recorded in 89 or 90. But I like it a lot. They actually went on to a fair amount of fame with their next album called Last Splash. There were some lineup changes between this album and that one. Yeah, I'm not sure if there's too much else that I want to say about this. When I was listening to it this week, I was like, I don't know if Travis is going to like this. And I will say, I know you didn't like all of it, but I'm willing to bet there were parts of it that you liked. There were some songs that you liked, even if as a whole, this wasn't your bag. But that's my guess. What do you think, Trev?
I love that you said that this was well recorded, because I will absolutely give you that, and agree with the immediacy that you mentioned and the feeling that you are kind of there in the room with real musicians playing and singing. Ultimately, this was really not my bag. I struggled with figuring out how to describe this music without being too critical, and also without reusing some of the descriptives that I've used in the past, because I don't think this was noisy. Mm-hmm. Which I've used to describe things before. I do think it was a little disjointed. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was morose in the way that I have sometimes described this authentic music that we've listened to in the past, where it's just too dour. Mm-hmm. It's not that, but... I really didn't enjoy the experience of listening to this. The first time I listened to it was on my walk on Monday. So like right after you assigned it, I went on a hike and I was gung-ho. I was really excited to just give it its first chance. And it didn't fit that activity. It didn't really fit what I like about music. The kind of lack of good melody and hooks and kind of an orchestration. Here's that might be something. I do feel like maybe the different parts of the band weren't necessarily trying to work together in a cohesive way.
Mm-hmm.
It felt. And I think that's why disjointed might be a really good descriptor for it. They felt like they were all kind of doing their thing at the same time,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily together. I do understand that this type of music is appealing to a certain type of listener. And, mm-hmm. and so I won't say that it's bad, because I think it's just not my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be curious to hear you break them down a little bit more and talk about the things that you like, because I'll be honest, there wasn't a lot for me to like about this. I will add, you did say that you suspected there were songs that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
I think I listened to it once more today.
Mm-hmm.
Just before I wanted to get it one fresh one that was in my brain, but I didn't between Monday and today. I couldn't bring myself to listen to it again, and so I don't have a super critical deconstruction of each song.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard for me to separate an individual song from the entire vibe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, one of the things that you've talked about in the past and that we both like about certain albums is that there's a variety, right? And I feel like there really is a variety of music on this album, and even within songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like you necessarily know where each song is going to go. And that kind of reminds me of somebody else we listened to maybe a month ago, Slothrust, right? There's... all kinds of different music going on here. There's some sort of dissonant, almost jazzy things. There's sort of light, female singing, you know, la-la-la type of things. There's some pretty heavy hitting drums occasionally. There's a lot of different parts that I think you're right are sort of working at cross purposes a lot of the time, right? There's not a whole lot of like, let's all get into a groove together and jam out, right? This is very constructed music. And, you know, I do think it all fits together, but they're never, they're like, you would never like head bob to this music, right? Because that's not the type of music that it is. It's a little more, it's a little more academic almost. You know what I mean? It's a little more.
Expand on that a little bit.
Well, you know, like for instance, we're going to put these notes in specifically because they're dissonant, right? We're going to change keys in the middle of the song. We're going to do things because we can to see if we can make them work. And I would say sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. The thing that I really like about them is that when they do kind of come out the other end of their sort of more experimental stuff, there are some really, I see, you said this wasn't hooky, but I feel like there are definitely some hooky bit. You know, I'm thinking of like the song Hellbound, right? That just has, you know, a repeating chorus about hellbound, 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 right? And that I definitely was singing to myself long after the song was over. There's a bunch of songs like that that just have little phrases. You know, this is not storytelling music at all. It's really individual songs that are sort of evoking a mood. And I think there's a pretty wide variety of moods on the album. So, you know, I think all of your observations are really good. I just think I have more of an appreciation for those aspects of this music than you do. But the things that you're saying about it absolutely are true. Like that 100% makes sense to me. And I get that you wouldn't like that, right? Like, this is definitely something where I wanted to give it to you because a lot of what Steve Albini recorded was like sort of dirty punk bands and people that were just making a lot of noise, right? And this is like quiet for a Steve Albini recorded album, you know?
Yeah, and I could definitely.
And so I thought we had a better chance of this being something that you could sort of connect with.
Yeah, I could see how this is not the same as the things that I would heretofore have called noisy, right? Mm-hmm. And just cacophonous. And this wasn't that. It just didn't kind of go into my brain the right way. In a way that I like about music. And I think that I am probably not so experimental of a person. And I think that doesn't just go for music. I feel like when I was younger and everybody knew that I was a film guy, everybody expected me to be into like indie films and, you know, like, oh, you must love so-and-so and, oh, you must love Aronofsky's early work. And I was like, no, I really am kind of a, like a blockbuster movie guy, but with standards. Like, and I think the same thing holds to music. Well, you know,
that's a really interesting observation. And I think at some point I'd like to have a conversation about that because I think that's part of the fundamental disconnect between us, right? Is that I don't know that I am mostly a blockbuster guy. I mean, certainly there are lots of blockbusters that I like. And it's funny, when we talked about the early 80s last two or three weeks ago, you named a bunch of blockbusters that I really love, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, I totally get that. And that's an okay thing to be, right? There's nothing, you know, people want to look down on that, but it's popular for a reason. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the same thing happens with music too. And I do have an appreciation for, there isn't a lot of music that I like that isn't well-known music, you know? Mm-hmm. And partly that's because of, I just have not been exposed to a whole lot, and that's why we do this. Mm-hmm. But also I think that it speaks to my general mindset about appreciating stuff with a budget. And kind of maybe there's something about it that's actual or real thing where the cream tends to rise to the top, and and so being a fan of the stuff on top is okay. And so that's just kind of what I do. So
yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
I'm afraid I don't have a lot else to add to this. I did think her voice was interesting. Is it just one singer?
Yeah, I was actually curious about that. I think the primary vocalist is Kim Deal, but that Tanya Donnelly also does contribute vocals. So they both play guitar and they both sing. Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah. There was, I would have pointed out a couple of bits. Like, I wish we could play clips on the show. But there were a couple of bits where I noted that the singing was either interesting or catchy in some way that was like, okay, you know, and I'll kind of like file that away to be like, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, she's got a bit of an ethereal quality to her voice at times that I really, really like. And they used it a lot in Pixies as well. She's not the primary vocalist in Pixies, but she does background vocals a lot in that band, and to great effect.
All right. Interesting. Do you have anything else you want to add about these guys?
No, I think I'm ready for you to rate it, give it a rating, figure out what you're going to rate it, and then move on.
So I didn't hate it.
Really? I'm actually surprised to hear that, because what you've described to me sounds like a pretty negative experience.
It was a negative experience. It wasn't a pretty negative experience. You know, I feel like there's worse stuff out there for me. So with that in mind, I'm going to give this a 2. So pretty low, but not the lowest.
Yeah, that's pretty close to the lowest though. Like you definitely led me to believe it was going to be higher than a 2 just now.
Oh. Sorry.
Really? I'm curious about that. So there's no rating that if you hate music, you give it a 1 regardless. Like music that you hate.
If there's nothing redeeming, if there's nothing at all redeeming about it that I can think of, then yeah, I would give a 1.
But see, that's interesting, right? Cause like, I don't necessarily hate, or find nothing redeeming about music that I hate, you know? Like, there's lots of music that I hate that is, I can say, oh, yeah, it's beautifully performed, or this person is one of the best bass players of all time, or whatever.
Matt, I'll be super honest with you. Yeah. I had a hard time finding stuff to like about this.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I was confused when you said you didn't hate it. So,
I guess there is a difference between having hard time finding something to like and hate. I hate as a general rule, you know. I really shy away from strong negative emotions. Like in my life, I tend to be a very like let's, you know, water rolls off your back type of thing. But me being a duck and water, you know,
I got that.
So thank you.
Yeah, that was a really great reference to water off a duck's back, but out through the back door and everything. So that was great.
Yeah.
I think this, for me, is a 7. I like it a lot. It's sort of, I would say it's very default 1990 indie rock, right? I would say there's better stuff out there, and there's a lot of worse stuff out there. So...
So when in the 90s, in the early 90s, so I guess when you were, who we're talking, high school senior, going into college. No. Barely getting to high school.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So this is high school freshman.
I didn't hear this music when I was solidly in like mainstream radio in 1990. Right. This
good. Is good. Okay. So that's what I was asking.
This is, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you were getting into like stuff
REO
like this
Speedwagon
in college
back then. Sorry?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. When I was in like middle school and high school, I was listening to a lot of like 50s and 60s music. Yeah. And of course, the 80s were always a part of my life and always will be. But yeah, it's interesting. So, okay. I was just curious if you were listening when you kind of got into this.
Yeah. No, this would be more recent.
Okay. All right. Good to know.
So, Travis, tell me about Chinatown.
Oh, Chinatown. So Chinatown is an American movie classic. And it is not until this viewing that I have become aware of some elephants that are just creeping around the room here. And so we'll talk about those.
Good. I'm really glad to hear that, actually.
Good, yeah. So, the short and skinny of it is that Chinatown is from 1974. It's kind of a neo-noir mystery. It was directed by Roman Polanski and written by Robert Towne. Stars Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, as well as several others. And it is at least a really interesting detective story. It has levels. It has kind of fake outs and turns and twists, and there is one really big twist, and it I think holds up in that regard. And also the performances, as being a 70s film about the early 1900s, probably 1920s, 30s, something along there.
Yeah, they do talk about it in the movie. It's in the 30s.
Great. Okay, so it's kind of has something to do with the LA water wars, which were a big thing. And I was a fan of, I did my a paper in college about that before I even moved to LA. I found it a fascinating subject. And so it was interesting to see kind of a fictionalized version of that here. Jack Nicholson puts in a really interesting performance. I really enjoyed him. And that's not always the case. So, I guess. Oh, one other thing that's interesting that popped up for me is Jerry Goldsmith is the composer that did the music for this, and he has done a ton of things. But interestingly, he did the music for Alien, and there are several music cues in this movie that you can hear 5 years later in Alien by Ridley Scott. So I thought that was fairly fascinating. But Matt, what did you think about Chinatown?
Yeah, I would say I had pretty complex feelings about Chinatown, to be perfectly honest with you,
okay.
Right?
Let's break them down.
Well, so, I mean, the first thing, right, like you get the opening credits and you're like, directed by Roman Polanski, and you're like, oh, that's right. This is the last movie that Roman Polanski directed in the United States before he fled the United States because he raped a child. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of icky, but I don't feel like me watching this on a streaming service is supporting Roman Polanski in any way. So I can separate that out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting experience because it's a 50-year-old movie that is a callback to an earlier style of movie that was popular in the 40s and 50s about the 1930s, right? And so there's all these layers of like history that are wrapped up in watching this movie because you're watching an old movie about older times and it's a fictionalized version and so on. And I'm not a huge noir film fan, but I've watched a few film noirs and I enjoy them, right? I'm not like into them, right? So I'm with the gangsters and the, you know, the, oh gosh, the femme fatales and the
right.
Detectives with a hard boiled past and all that stuff. You know, I would say I have an emotional distance from it. But this movie, I think, has sort of an emotional distance from the tropes of film noir. It almost feels like a film school film to me in a way. Right?
Hmm.
Like somebody gave him an assignment that was like, make a film noir, right? And so he did, right? It's very sort of faithful to the tropes of the thing. You know, it uses, and I think this is a deliberate choice, it uses this very faded color palette that's still color, but it's like kind of black and whitey. You know, that's pretty fascinating. Jack Nicholson's in almost every single shot, not every single shot, but every single scene of this movie. He might be in every single scene. It's almost told from his point of view, but outside of his head. I can't remember. Is that first person non-omniscient or something? I can't remember.
Oh, no, that'd be a third person something or other.
Oh, yeah. But anyways, you know, and that's all really interesting and good. Couple of things that were a little negative for me. One, it's pretty long, like pretty long. And I wouldn't say it's super, it's well paced, right? But it is just long.
It's just over 2 hours. It's not super long, but it does feel it because it is a little languid.
I mean, things keep happening, you know, they're mm-hmm. keeping like sort of double crosses and he finds out new information and there's a lot there, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, one of the things I like about that, just to pause for real quick, and I was thinking about that because it took me twice two sessions to watch this movie this week.
That is fascinating because me too.
Yeah, and that's not necessarily. I could have made it all the way through. It just I was doing stuff, and I took a break and didn't.
And you
want to
pay attention, right? It's very easy to, like, if you lose the thread of this movie, to just be like, oh, what's going on, right?
Yes, yes, and so if you're watching it alone, it's easy to be distracted by other things, and so you and one of the things I liked about the pace is that it's feeding you information. Everything that happens matters, but it doesn't feel like it matters in the moment necessarily. And so if they tried to cram it all in with stuff that, you know, every single sentence was important, then you could cut down the running time a little bit. But I think the way they did it, it's much more of a character-y, it feels real while also feeling noir.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that part of that is that they shot it even with this faded color palette that you mentioned. It's not shot in a way that some of those older detective movies were, with really harsh shadows and and high contrast. And so I think that the reality of this movie feels more real.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I actually think that the things that you learn and the twists that come along the way are more impactful mm-hmm. in a way. So
yeah. So we should probably talk about the twist. I just don't know if I want to get into the twist yet. Why don't you ask me a few questions first?
Questions. Oh, I don't know about questions, but a couple things that I took note of that I thought were interesting is the detectiveness of this movie. Jake Gittes as a actual detective is decent at his job. He doesn't just come across information. He has to go out and get it. He's out there taking pictures and he's being sly about how he's following people. And he does this thing at one point where he puts a pocket watch under the wheel of a car and in order so that he doesn't have to sit there and watch the car, he just has to go back for the watch. And when the watch is broken, when the car drives off over it, that's when they know that they've got their guy. But you also don't see that happen. You see him place the pocket watch, and then you see him looking at the pocket watch. But you don't actually... no one says, oh, the car drove over the watch at, you know, this time. You just hear him say, oh, he was there all night. And you have to put those kind of pieces together. And I really appreciate a movie that allows your audience to put pieces together for themselves and think about things. Even lines of dialogue, and we'll get into the twist, but there's a bit there too where it's not explicitly said. Well, there is something that's not explicitly said, but it is alluded to, but it's very clear. It's just the way it's acted and presented. There was another moment where someone had to do it had to do with his detective. Oh, he has to follow a car, so he breaks the red covering on the rear taillight, so that instead of a red taillight, it's a white taillight, and that makes it easier for him to follow at night. Which I thought was just that's stuck with me as a viewer since the first time I ever saw this movie, and I remember just thinking that was kind of an ingenious way to go about following someone. We can talk. We don't have unlimited time. We can talk about the twist.
So the twist is that Faye Dunaway's character is a victim of incest with her father, and that the woman who... So, and I was a little unclear with this. Was her husband actually canoodling with the woman?
No, they were he was a father figure.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Yeah,
but it's one of those things.
We as the audience and the main character Jake are led to believe that he is investigating Mr. Mulray, who is the head of the water department, that he's investigating him for having an affair with this young girl. And he never sees them kissing. He never sees them doing anything.
But he sees them embrace, I think.
Embracing, but, yeah. And so so he takes pictures of that, and then it gets into the newspaper, and so everyone thinks, that he's having an affair. And you're right. So And this is a moment that has become a trope, I feel. And I feel I would be surprised if you had never heard the, she's my daughter, she's my sister, she's my daughter.
No.
Have you never heard that?
No.
Okay. So that is the big climax of the movie where Faye Dunaway is protecting this girl. And Jake thinks she is kidnapping her, right?
Yeah, kidnapping her.
Yeah. And so... And so Jake is making Faye Dunaway tell him who she is, and she admits that she's her sister first, right? And he's like, well, that's fine. If she's your sister, she's your sister. What's the big deal? And then it comes out that that she's his daughter. And here's the thing that's really interesting. And I think this is why it being directed by the person it's directed by makes it weirder. And that is that when Jake asks Faye Dunaway if her father raped her and that's why she had this kid, she says, no.
So I think you know that at that point I was like, no.
Yeah, me too.
Because this is a dude who very famously thinks it's okay to have sex with 14-year-olds and... As a podcast, I think we can comfortably say it is our collective view that that is not okay. And that is rape both in real life and the law. So,
right. And so for that, and there was no real reason that that had to be, case in the story.
Yeah. He didn't have to ask that question and she didn't have to answer it the way she did. And
it could have been involuntary, it could have been a bad situation, but for it to be a consensual relationship was a very weird thing. And I didn't remember that being the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen this movie as recently as just a few years ago when I went to the Blu-ray re-release at Paramount and saw it on the big screen.
You had forgotten that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'd block it out too, so.
Well, yeah, but it's not the point of this movie by any... It's a tiny little element, and it's only informed by the director. And if it was any other director, it probably would be a thing that we wouldn't be harping about.
I mean, I like to think that I would call that out, because it depends on a pretty harmful trope.
I don't think so, Matt. I would say that there are... Listen, the world is a complex place. Relationships like that probably exist in the world that are for sure rape, but where both parties don't feel like it is, right?
Sure.
And so if it had been a more respected director and that just was the relationship that these two characters had, I probably wouldn't have blinked about it. It would have been a thing that it would have just gone by. But to me, it's the involvement of this director that really makes that icky. Yeah. This guy.
Well, so we should probably move on to the end of the movie, which is also icky, right?
Yeah.
Because all the good guys die in the
Faye Dunaway is trying to keep her daughter from her father.
Yeah.
And her father, that's kind of the really, we learn that that's the driving motivation through the whole movie is the father, the Noah Cross, the rich guy who was Faye Dunaway's father.
Right.
He wants his other daughter back.
And I think so here is the thing that I think bothers me the most about this movie, right?
Yeah.
Is that all of that stuff is, you know, okay, good family drama affecting whatever, right? But this is nominally a noir about the water wars, and none of that stuff is necessary for that story, right?
Well, that's a red herring.
Yeah, except it ends up being like the sort of plot driver of the last third of the movie, you know? So...
Well, but not only is it a red herring, it does have something to do with it, right? So it's not completely irrelevant.
I'm just saying, like, I think you can write a really great version of this movie that doesn't include any of that.
Oh, wow. See, that's where we disagree. I do think that this, as a screenplay, is a really great version of this movie. I think this screenplay is wonderful.
I'm just saying... Look, I'll bet you could write Chinatown without that plot, right? You could write some different interpersonal thing that does a lot of the same work and doesn't make me want to take a shower and then take another shower and then take my skin off and wash my skin and then take another shower. So
was it really all that bad for you?
Yes.
Okay. Huh. Interesting. All right.
Yeah.
All right. So
here's the thing. The old guy grabs the daughter at the end of the movie, even though everybody is witness to a scene that appears to implicate him in some way, even if they don't get the details, right? And this guy has been shot.
To everybody else, other than Jake, to everybody else, this girl is his granddaughter.
No, Faye Dunaway. Faye Dunaway shoots him for a reason. And the idea that this guy would be able to just walk away from the scene.
Well, he doesn't. We don't see the rest of the scene, but he is also obscenely wealthy, right?
I just think, look, it was tremendously unsatisfying to me that he just walks off with this girl at the end of the
movie. It's supposed to be.
That's why
the guy's lying. And that line at the end, which is so funny that it's a kind of a throwaway line in the moment, has become the key to this movie. When anybody talks about this movie, they know the line, "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown." And it's parodied on The Simpsons. It's been like, that line embodies everything about this movie. And so it's about a character who... you know, Jake wants to care, but it just isn't worth it because it's the way things work in this town. And unfortunately, in the world, the rich guy manages to walk away from a situation like that, probably with his granddaughter in tow, / daughter.
Oh, man.
I don't like it. I don't think you're supposed to like it. It's supposed to be unsettling, but that's what keeps this movie with you. That's why this movie has stayed with me for so long. I mean, it's an unsettling movie, and I think it's supposed to be on purpose. It's not supposed to be a happy ending.
No,
right? It's like Romeo and Juliet. It's that's an unsettling ending too.
It's not supposed to be a happy ending. I get that.
Okay, I mean. So I don't get the point in decrying its unsettlingness when that is the point. Like it's a psychological drama, and I think the script is brilliant. Other than that one tiny little thing, I think it's a brilliant script. Like I even like the situation, the idea that this guy fathered a granddaughter with his daughter is an insane plot element that I think makes this movie, it doesn't make it movie, but it that's a big part of what makes this movie so impactful, right? I just don't like the idea that it was a consensual relationship. I don't think we needed that, but
I mean, this movie has definitely knocked the wind out of my sails a little bit, so you know, as, you can probably tell. Yeah.
All righty. Well, I guess, I mean, shoot, unless there's anything more to be said, we can go ahead and rate it.
Is there anything more to say? Big cast of a lot of guys in suits that are hard to tell apart, you know?
Yeah, lots and lots and lots of white guys. Although here, wasn't it interesting to see James Hong,
yes,
as the butler?
I was like, James Hong. And then of course he ends up being a relatively important character, right? Cause the first time you see him, you're like, oh, well, wow, James Hong is in this. And then you expect to not see him for the rest of the movie, but it turns out he's pretty important.
Yeah.
So that was cool. Yeah.
Yeah, it was neat. He's still going strong. Like, I have a friend who just directed him in something, you know, this year. So
nice.
And of course, he was in Everything Everywhere All at Once, which we loved last year.
Yeah.
So good stuff. I also really do like the music and the tone and the filming. The cinematography, I think, is pretty great. There's a moment where Jake is accosted by these two guys, and someone sticks a switchblade up his nose and
yeah,
cuts
I think
out
that
of his
tough
nose.
Is played by Roman Polanski, by the way.
Oh, really?
Okay, yeah, I was Googling about that, and I think that guy is Roman Polanski.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. I think I read that same thing, and I was wondering if that's because they needed to trust the actor who was doing that, but like, I have no idea how that was done. It looked like a pretty interesting...
He had a blood capsule behind the knife with a little ejector on it, so when he moves the knife away, he fires off the blood capsule and it shoots onto his nose. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, it looks really convincing and it's a jarring moment. And
it is a very
jarring
moment. Yeah.
I think a lot of that. And the production value, I think, was fantastic. And it really did a good job of transporting us into an early Los Angeles.
Yeah, which, shooting on location when that was not nearly as easy to do as it is today.
Yeah, and now that I live here, it's a fairly interesting thing to kind of look back on and see those things too. So
yeah.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and rate it. We're running out of time anyway.
Yeah. I think for me, this is probably, it's really, really a very good movie. I really love the way that it doles out information and that the way that it sticks with Gittes and you find out information. I feel like this movie plays fair with information in a way that a lot of these movies don't. I don't feel like this movie is hiding the ball all the time. So
and
I
you've
really
talked about
like
that. In the
that.
Past where,
I would say where... the first two thirds of this movie, I really, really love. And then once we start to get into the weeds of that whole situation, I'm not as into that. So I'm going to give it a two-thirds kind of rating, which would be a 7. So this is a 7 for me.
Okay. All right. Great. I think that this is a 9 for me. I think this is a true cinema classic. It's not even modern classic. It's, I mean, 1974 is kind of my cutoff with that's the year Jaws came out. And so generally I will say that, you know, what I tell people about my movie taste is that pre-Jaws is a harder sell for me. But I think that this is a real classic. I think it's brilliantly acted. I think it is very well directed. The script is, I think, perfect. And other than that one, and it wasn't even a line. It was that's the thing. Like, it could have been, I think that moment could have acted many different ways and given different meaning to that relationship. But because of the take that they used, made it weird.
Yeah.
So,
for sure.
And that,
for
I guess,
sure.
might be worth a point off. But
all right. A 9 and a 7 for Chinatown, a 2 and a 7 for The Breeders. Travis, what do you have for me next week?
You know what? I just want to take it easy this week. I want to give you a nice breezy horror movie, to kind of like a palate cleanser, if you will. Let me ask you a movie. Would you rather see a horror movie about a bad guy who can't see or a good guy who can't hear?
Probably a bad guy who can't see.
Oh, interesting. All right. Well, then I'm going to give you the movie Don't Breathe. And it is essentially a home invasion movie, but the heroes are doing the invading, and they are invading the home of a blind man who doesn't end up being so incapable and such an easy mark. And that's all I will tell you about this movie. So the movie is Don't Breathe.
All right, cool. Well, have you ever heard of the band Mr. Wives?
No.
I know you haven't. It's a play on the term Sister Wives, right? But they're an indie rock band from mid-2010s. And I'm going to give you their debut album from 2015. It is called On Our Own House. And it's upbeat. It's fun. It's enjoyable. I really like it. I hope you really like it, too. I don't really know much about the band. I'll do some research this week. This is an album that I really love, though, so...
Great.
I hope you can
love
it.
I love to experience things that you love.
Do you love Don't Breathe?
No. This is a palate cleanser. This is a movie that I've seen once and really enjoyed, and I think it does something very interesting by making the heroes the bad guys in the situation. Yeah. I think there's so much interesting about this movie. And it was also directed by Fede Alvarez, who has gone on to do the new Evil Dead movie. And also, I think he's directing the new Alien movie that's coming out this year, which I'm super excited about. So nice. I'm really interested to revisit this for that reason.
Heads up, I've never seen Prometheus, so I don't know if you'd like that. Don't.
No, okay. No. It's way, 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 way down on my list of movies.
Okay.
It's not good.
All right. Well, Travis, if people want to write to us and tell us how our opinions are garbage, they can do so at exposingourselvespodcast@gmail.com, or they can swing by our Facebook page, search Exposing Ourselves, and tell us how wrong we are.
Yes, and my pledge to you is to start posting the posters and album art for all these things we're discussing, so that you can more keenly contribute your thoughts to the specific thing that we're talking about.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
Well, thank you very much, Matt, for exposing yourself to me.
Hey, Travis. Thank you for exposing yourself to me.